Welcome to Session 9, The Cosmic Eye. In previous sessions, we explored the domain of consciousness by looking at the quantum to see if the realm of the micro might enlighten us about the nature of consciousness. Now, in this session, we will shift our focus from the micro to the macro and begin to explore different meanings of cosmic consciousness, such as all-pervasive universal awareness and highest state of consciousness. We will investigate the difference between transcendent and immanent cosmic consciousness, that is, between an objective out-there Godhead type of consciousness and an immanent in all parts of the universe kind of consciousness. We will compare the psycho-spiritual development of individual beings toward the highest state of consciousness in mystical experience and the cosmic evolutionary unfolding of cosmic consciousness from light to enlightenment. And we will conclude this session by looking at physicist David Bohm's implicate order and its relevance to consciousness studies, particularly his highly effective form of dialogue, and by revisiting Arthur Young's reflexive arc model of the cosmic journey of involution and evolution. So in many ways, the exploration of cosmic consciousness is about the search for meaning. And the question that motivates this search is, does the universe have purpose and meaning beyond our own projections? In other words, does the cosmos have a mind of its own? Is there a universal or cosmic consciousness? And if so, how might we be related to it? Well, first, we need to find out what we mean by cosmic consciousness. And there are two basic meanings. One is cosmic consciousness can mean all-pervasive universal awareness, which would be a timeless form of consciousness. And the second is the highest state of consciousness, which would be evolutionary. So let's take each of those in turn. First, the meaning of all-pervasive universal awareness for cosmic consciousness. This, in turn, has two kinds of meaning. The first meaning of all-pervasive universal awareness is the meaning of Godhead, that there is some transcendent, objective being consciousness that's out there. It's a form of consciousness and intelligence that would be experienced by the universe as a whole, and it's so utterly advanced and beyond our experience that we can only guess its nature and existence. It would be the universe's own consciousness and its sense of singular self-identity that we might call the cosmic eye. We could call it the wise God in the sense that it would be the repository of supreme intelligence. Then the second meaning of all-pervasive universal awareness is the view from panpsychism that that this divine consciousness is immanent in all parts of the universe. It's all-pervasive because it exists in all parts of the cosmos. It would be primordial, an elemental awareness that is a constituent of all entities throughout the cosmos. In this meaning of all-pervasive universal awareness, there would be multiple, perhaps infinite, centers of consciousness spread throughout the cosmos. Now, in contrast to the Godhead form of consciousness, we might call this the dumb God. In other words, it would be a low level of intelligence that would be evolving from subatomic particles through atoms, through molecules, through cells and various kinds of organisms to higher organisms, evolving to higher and higher stages of consciousness. But at its basic primordial level, it would have a very low level of intelligence. So we might see this as a version of God as dumb, as opposed to the Godhead transcendent consciousness of supreme intelligence, which would see God as supremely wise. Well, that's the first meaning of cosmic consciousness, the all-pervasive form of consciousness, the all-pervasive universal awareness. The second meaning of cosmic consciousness is the highest state of consciousness. And again, there are two sub-meanings here. The first is mystical experience. It refers to individuals developing a higher state of consciousness, beyond self-reflective awareness that leads to a unitive consciousness and an identity with the whole cosmos. It would involve a sense of oneness with the cosmic eye, that mystical experience involves that sense of unity between the individual and the ultimate cosmic eye. That's experienced by individual beings, yet related to the unity of the whole. The second meaning of the highest state of consciousness is that it's the highest evolutionary stage. In other words, it would refer to the possibility of whole species, or perhaps even life or matter itself, evolving toward greater and greater degrees of spiritual awareness. From this perspective, the cosmos as a whole is becoming self-aware. We would see it as the cosmic evolution of consciousness. Okay, so those are some of the meanings of cosmic consciousness. Basically, what we are looking at here is the relationship between consciousness and the cosmos, and basically looking for a cosmology that includes consciousness. Now, physicist David Bohm, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, particularly in the domain of quantum theory, produced a cosmology that, based in quantum physics, that accounts for consciousness in a way that other theories of quantum physics do not. Bohm said that a complete theory of the cosmos, a cosmology, must take account of consciousness. Clearly, consciousness exists in the universe, and any complete theory of the cosmos has to account for that fact of consciousness. He pointed to the fact, too, that quantum theory now has to recognize the inevitability of a participatory observer that erodes the separation between subject and object, between knower and known, between inner and outer. Bohm said that behind the domain of the quantum, beyond relativity theory and the four forces of physics, there is a unified field, and that the knower is integral to that field, that the knower is an integral element in the unified field. He said that reality, and that includes energy, matter, space, time, and consciousness, that reality is ultimately an undivided whole. That underlying the manifest physical and mental reality lies an even deeper reality of an unmanifest matrix that gives rise to both matter and consciousness. Manifest reality, that is the domain of matter and mind, that manifest reality is enfolded in the unmanifest. And he said that manifest reality is the explicate order, and unmanifest reality is the implicate order. Thus, he concluded, something of the nature of intelligence, a purposeful ordering, is embedded in the most fundamental fabric of reality itself. The implicate order is the source of manifest subject, in other words, consciousness, and manifest substance, that is, matter energy. So the implicate order is the source of subject and substance, of consciousness and energy. The implicate order, he said, is inherently dynamic. It's in constant movement, and it's a whole, and he referred to this nature of the implicate order, the fundamental nature of reality, as holo-movement, that it's both whole and dynamic. And furthermore, he said that this holo-movement is a purposeful process. There is purpose and intelligence intrinsic to this fundamental dynamic nature of reality in the implicate order. So that in some ways is the context for Bohm's cosmology. Now, relating that to consciousness, he said that thoughts are static habits of mind, that the thoughts that we have are a kind of fossilized consciousness that operates only within the domain of the known, only within the domain of what we know. But that reality, the deeper reality of the implicate order, is unknown by thought. Thought cannot reach into the implicate order. Thoughts cannot comprehend the unmanifest implicate order. And that any thoughts we have automatically distort reality. So any thoughts that we have about the nature of the unmanifest are already automatically a distortion of the true nature of the unmanifest. Bohm made a crucial distinction between thoughts and what he called thinking, or the process of thinking, what we would typically call consciousness, or the arising of awareness. He said that only the process of thinking, not any static thoughts, not ideas or concepts, but only the process of thinking that's experienced moment to moment can participate in knowing the unknown. So thoughts cannot access the unknown, but thinking can, because it participates in the unknown, in fact, arises from the unmanifest, from the unknown. The process of thinking, therefore, he said, is very different from the forms of thought. Thinking is experienced, whereas thought is conceptualized or verbalized. Bohm pointed out that reality is, or at least can be, revealed through awareness of thinking itself, by paying attention to the process of our thinking, to the process of the arising of consciousness and awareness within our own bodies. He said that it's not what we think that matters, but how we think. He pointed out that the separate, isolated thinker of thoughts is an illusion, that all there is, really, is the flow of the holo movement that manifests in thinking. He pointed out that immense amounts of cosmic energy are invested in the illusions of a thinker and thoughts, and that diligent practice is needed to dissolve the illusion of thinker, which we would experience as psychological death. And when successful, that process results in a vast liberation of energy, otherwise that's used to keep in place the illusion of a separate thinker of thoughts. The paradox, therefore, from this perspective, is that the more we talk or think about reality or truth, the less it is revealed, because thoughts and ideas and words and language cannot access it. Thinking about reality never gets us there, because our thinking is reality. Now, this is not to say that all that reality is thinking, but it means that one way that reality, the unmanifest, the implicate order, one way that reality shows up is in our thinking. So, instead of asking people, how are you today, we might ask them, how are you thinking today? How are you thinking today? Directing attention to how we are thinking, to the process of our thinking. In a kind of Zen koan, David Bohm pointed out that thoughts about thinking are not thinking, nor is thinking about thoughts thinking. Not even thinking about thinking is thinking, but that thinking is thinking. So let me just go over that again. Thoughts about thinking are not thinking, nor is thinking about thoughts thinking. Not even thinking about thinking is thinking, but thinking is thinking. In other words, just the process itself without anything else added. It's as if you are not thinking, but thinking is you-ing. That the cosmic holo movement is thinking through you, or indeed is thinking you into being. So to get at reality, you, that is the individual ego, must get out of the way. And of course this is the essence of the world's great spiritual traditions, that to get at the deep nature of the truth, the deep nature of existence or being, the ego must dissolve. The way to knowledge, therefore, is through an emptiness of thoughts, or what the Buddhists call no-self, anatta. Bohm pointed out that when consciousness as knower vanishes, then reality as known, or reality as it is, arises. So without the I, thinking, that is, consciousness, functions naturally in the deep structure of the implicate order and has access to information embedded in the whole. Thus, pure thinking has access to the whole cosmos through its implicate order. Pure thinking is beyond concepts and words, and therefore silence is the optimum mode of discourse or dialogue for deep knowing. What matters most to David Bohm is whether and how thinking our thinking transforms us. His philosophical physics is a pragmatic ethics. He believed that unless we can develop as moral beings, that all thinking and dialogue are wasted, literally wasting the breath and spirit of the cosmos. Now, I have mentioned in other sessions that I've been exploring, writing, and teaching about consciousness for decades, and that the more I do, the more I'm persuaded that the most effective way to study consciousness is to shut up, to get beyond words, beyond concepts, beyond thinking, and to allow ourselves to drop down into feeling, into the moment and moment lived experience of consciousness. Silence, I find, is the best medium, therefore, for exploring consciousness, especially if we wish to go deep or to soar high. But moving into silence doesn't have to mean giving up thinking and talking altogether. But it does mean using silence to clear enough psychic space, so to speak, to allow ourselves to feel our thinking, to feel our thinking as it arises in and through us. Now, perhaps paradoxically, the most effective way I've come across for exploring consciousness through silence is something that David Bohm called dialogue. It's a form of relational communication devised by Bohm in partnership with spiritual teacher Krishnamurti. And I'd like to say a little bit now about Bohmian dialogue. To participate in this form of dialogue is an opportunity to explore the possibility of experiencing what group consciousness is like. Most of us are familiar only with our own sense of individual consciousness, but in sessions like Bohmian dialogue, we do have the opportunity to literally feel the pulse of the organism's consciousness, the consciousness of the group. In Bohmian dialogue, the only aim is to explore consciousness collectively, to see if we can discover the sources of fragmentation in our thinking that are then reflected in society and the rest of the world. So the only aim of dialogue is to explore consciousness collectively and to see what we can do to restore wholeness by paying attention to the fragmentation in our thinking. So in essence, dialogue is a way for a group to think and feel together, to collectively explore the spontaneous unfolding of meaning. The original meaning of consciousness, conscire, it's a Latin word, means to know with others. In other words, consciousness means knowing together. And that's what dialogue is about. It's sitting in a group of up to 24, 25 people. Dialogue honors the profound power of silence as the source of wisdom in our speaking. In dialogue, we are encouraged to feel our thinking, to pay attention to the feelings in our bodies, what Bohm called our proprioception, to pay attention to those feelings as messages, literally as messages that inform our thinking and our thoughts. Now, although we can't participate in a Bohmian dialogue session here via a recorded lecture, I do want, however, to spend a few moments introducing some of the key points that make this mode of communication so effective and special. Typically, a Bohmian dialogue group consists of from 10 to 25 people. Sometimes smaller or larger groups do meet, but Bohm reported that in his experience, the optimum size for such a group is between 20 and 24 people. Groups usually meet regularly, could be weekly or monthly, and they often do so for many months or years at a time. The longer a group is together, the more trust between people can build, and the work can go correspondingly deeper. Dialogue begins in silence. And from that moment on, there is usually no group leader. But a dialogue group is a leaderless group, or more accurately, it's a leaderful group, that everyone is responsible for the communication of the whole group until the end of the session. And sessions can start in the morning, go on all day into the evening, and then the group may come back and meet again in the morning for 2 days in a row. So frequently, Bohmian dialogue groups will meet at a weekend, either monthly, sometimes weekly, and can go on for many years. Now, in dialogue, there is no agenda. The content for communication is whatever the group picks up on, whatever surfaces from the silence of the group and individual consciousness is the substance of dialogue. And there are no rules as such in dialogue, yet certain procedures and guidelines, David Bohm discovered, do seem to work for group communications. And these include that only one person speaks at a time, and anything can be spoken. There is nothing off limits in a dialogue group. No topic, no political correctness need be involved in Bohmian dialogue. All the participants are encouraged to listen openly, suspending all evaluation and judgment, and suspending any prior expert knowledge that we think we might bring to the group. So we sit in the group with what the Zen tradition calls beginner's mind. In a dialogue group, we do not speak to force a point, or to win an argument, or to contradict what somebody else has had to say. Instead, we listen to what others say as a revelation from someone else's point of view, which otherwise would forever remain unknown to us. If you think about that, every time somebody speaks, especially if they're speaking authentically from the heart, it truly is a revelation to us. It is revealing to us how the universe shows up from that perspective, through that person's eyes. And the only way we can ever know how the universe looks, how the world looks from that person's perspective, is if they grace us, if they give us the gift of communicating to us their own experience and perspective. So in dialogue, we listen openly to what others have to say, as though it were a revelation, because truly it is a revelation. In dialogue, we speak if we have something to say, because each person's viewpoint is a valuable contribution. But silence, too, can be contribution. We don't have to speak in dialogue. Frequently in Bohmian dialogue sessions, there can be long stretches of silence, perhaps even for an hour or two or more. But the silence is also a deep communication. And when you participate in a Bohmian dialogue group, you get to recognize there are very different kinds of silence. There's the silence of withdrawal, where somebody may be not engaged in the group, has withdrawn into their own interiority, into their own subjective, isolated sense of consciousness. Some people may be silent because they are drifting off into sleep. There is the silence of kind of a petulant silence of people who don't want to participate. You can sense that difference. And then, of course, there's the silence of being deeply present, being deeply open and deeply listening, either to what someone else is saying or to the silence that is circulating between the participants in the group. The dialogue participants pay attention to the group process or dynamics, to the movement or the flow of consciousness through the group, so that when someone does speak, he or she does not close anybody else down. But of course, nor do we suppress our own speaking. So we pay attention to the flow of consciousness, to the holo movement throughout the group, and thereby we know when the appropriate time is to speak. Dialogue is not about providing solutions. It's about exploration. It's not about providing answers. In dialogue, we just openly explore. And dialogue does not aim to be therapeutic. It is not a therapy. Nevertheless, many people experience, after a session of dialogue, going deeply into collective consciousness and having the ability to share the deepest truths from their own being, that this experience can be profoundly therapeutic, even though that is not the aim of the process. And perhaps most important of all, in dialogue we listen not so much to the words that are spoken, but for the meaning of every communication. So in dialogue, we're not bringing our analytical, critical mind to evaluating the grammatical or the philosophical rigor that somebody is speaking, but to the meaning that's been expressed from the authenticity of their communication. As I said, dialogue is an opportunity to experience the subtle flow of consciousness through each of us individually and through the organism of the group as a whole. It is a way to deeply feel the source of our thinking, to learn to listen for meaning, and in doing so, to transcend the limitations of our individual minds. Fundamentally, dialogue is about being in relationship. It is a way of exploring consciousness in a community by enhancing the relational quality of our communication. It is an effective second-person methodology for exploring consciousness intersubjectively. Now, I've introduced David Bohm's dialogue to emphasize how a particular cosmology can have practical applications as well as profound implications. Bohm's physics and cosmology are all of the piece with his ethical stance towards other people and the rest of the world around us. Bohmian dialogue is a way to begin to experience the implicate order, that deeper domain than the quantum, the domain that is the source of cosmic intelligence. Now, like David Bohm's implicate order, Arthur Young's theory of process is also a cosmology with feet. It has practicality to it. It has practical applications in real-life situations. People have used Arthur Young's model for personal development and spiritual awakening, for health and healing, in business and organizational development, in education, in art. And as its name indicates, Arthur Young's theory is about the way processes, cosmic and mundane, how processes unfold. In Young's model, every process follows identifiable levels and stages. And we could sum up the stages as a trinity, as a fourfold, or as a sevenfold. Let's first look at the threefold. At its most essential, we could characterize the cosmic process in Arthur Young's model as a three-part sequence of involution, the turn of the turning point, and evolution. We could also describe it as stages in a journey, the leaving, which is involution, the turning point, or the turn, and the return, the going home, the process of evolution. These are also the fundamental elements of any dramatic story. In this case, it's the story of the cosmos itself. Now, Young's fourfold, he points out that besides the trinity of involution, turn, and evolution, his theory stands solidly on what he calls the fourfold, a fourfold process that shows up in many ways. For instance, the trinity becomes a fourfold by adding the final step that completes the journey that we could call the homecoming. So the process of journey can be understood to have these four stages: involution, the leaving, the turn, or the turning point, evolution, the returning, and finally, homecoming. Another aspect of Young's fourfold is his ontological levels, his four levels of being, his four levels of reality. Level one, we may remember, is the level of spirit, the level of the quantum, the photon of consciousness. And level one is point-like, it is dimensionless. Level two is the level of soul, the level of time, of forces, emotions, and subtle substance, or subtle energy. And it is line-like. So we have the point-like photon or spirit, and the line-like, the linearity of time, the domain of the soul at level two. Then at level three, we have mind, the domain of space, of forms, of identity, of concepts. And it is plane-like, like a sheet of paper. So we have a point, we have at level one, we have a line at level two, and at level three, we have a plane or an area. And then level four, the level of matter, is the level of time-space, of volume, of solid bodies. So again, briefly, level one is spirit, level two is soul, level three is mind, and level four is matter. And these are the stages in the process of involution from spirit through soul, through mind to matter. And now if we map out the three major levels of involution arriving at the turn, followed then by the three major levels of evolution, we get a seven-stage process outlined in Arthur Young's reflexive arc, which is at the center of his theory of process. So starting at level one on the left or downward side of the arc, we have the three stages of involution that we've just looked at, beginning with one spirit or the photon, followed by two, the domain of soul or forces of subatomic forces, leading then to level three, the level of atoms, the level of matter. Then at stage four, we have a level of molecules, of molecular matter, and this is the stage of the turn and represents a unique moment in every cyclical process. There is this turning point. So we've now come down through the three stages of involution, arriving at the turn, and then we now begin back up the ascent on the right-hand side of the arc, where we have now three additional stages of evolution. So after the turn, we have stage five, the stage of life, followed by stage six, the stage of mind, or self-reflective consciousness, leading back to stage seven, the homecoming in spirit. So we can image the reflexive arc beginning with the domain of the ineffable, unmanifest source. To recap, it's level one, it's the dimensionless point of spirit. Level two is the level of time, of linearity, of soul, of forces, of emotions, where there is one dimensionality, because spirit has now constrained itself, given up one degree of freedom. Then, at level three, we have space, the domain of animation. And at level four, we have matter, the domain of space-time. So, again, in involution, we begin at stage one with photons, dimensionless entities, the highest level where spirit resides. Its characteristic is potential. Then at stage two, we have the domain of forces, where the characteristic is the quality of binding, of forces binding together as in nuclear forces. Then at stage three, we have the domain of atoms. And these are the first arisings in the cosmos of beings or entities that have an identity. At the level two of forces, where we might talk about electrons or protons, for example, each electron is identical to every other electron, and every proton is identical to every proton, every neutron is identical to every neutron. But when we now come down in evolution to stage three, to the level of atoms, for the first time, there is now a difference between one particle or one entity and another, that different atoms have their own identities. We have an atom of hydrogen, an atom of carbon, an atom of oxygen, an atom of iron, and so on. That there is a differentiation now that enters into the flow of manifest reality at stage three. Then at stage four, lower than the atoms, is the domain of molecules. And here the essential characteristic at stage four is combination. Molecules combine together to form different kinds of matter in different degrees of complexity. And at that point, we have reached the turn, the turning point, from involution through stages 1, 2, 3, and 4. And now we begin on the right-hand side of the arc, the upward, the ascent in evolution. So at stage 5, we have the stage of life, where the central characteristic is growth. And growth has two aspects to it. It involves instinctive mind and egoic mind at stage five, in the domain of life. Then at stage six, we have the stage of mind, where the essential quality now is transformation. And in mind, we have two kinds of mind, or two levels of mind. We have the subtle mind that goes beyond the ego, and then beyond the subtle mind, there is the transpersonal mind at stage six. And finally, at stage seven, the stage of spirit, we've now returned back to spirit, where the characteristic, the central characteristic, is enlightenment. So again, we've gone through stage one, photons, stage two, in the involutionary process, from photons at stage one, to forces at stage two, to atoms at stage three, to molecules at stage four, the point of turn, the turning point, then moving back up on the other side of the arc, stage five, we have life, stage six, we have mind, and stage seven, we have returned to spirit. In addition to this ontology, or if you like, map of reality, of the nature of being, Arthur Young's model also includes an epistemology. He points out that there are different ways of knowing appropriate to each level. So, again, at level one, we have the dimensionless domain of spirit that can be accessed only through direct experience. Then at level two, the level of time, the level of soul, the level of feeling, the level of forces, that we know that level, we know the domain of soul through feeling and emotion. And then at level three, the domain of space is something we know through reason. It's the domain of space, the domain of mind. We know this through reason and logic. And finally, the level four, the level of matter, our bodies, we know through the senses. And we can map each of these four levels and four different ways of knowing to what I've called in my work the four gifts of knowing. So moving up again at the level of matter and bodies, we have the scientist's gift of using the senses, sensory empiricism, and the methodology of scientific investigation, the scientist's gift. Then at level three, moving back up, the level of space and mind, we have the philosopher's gift of reason and logic. Moving up further again to the level of soul, the level of time, we now have the shaman's gift of feeling and emotion. And then finally back to level one, the level of dimensionless spirit that we know only through direct experience, we encounter the mystic's gift of mystical experience and direct experience. So let us now take a closer look at Arthur Young's model, at some of the essential characteristics of his theory, and by focusing first on the fundamental photons, how the photon is so intrinsic to his model. Basing his work on discoveries in quantum physics, Arthur Young developed a new scientific model with the quantum of action as the most fundamental entity in the universe. The quantum of action, or the quantum, is also called the photon. And Young said that the quantum of action underlies all the processes of nature, and this, of course, is consistent with modern physics. Now, as the great Einstein knew, and of course as all physicists still know, this photon, this unit of light, is a highly mysterious thing. It is, in fact, the strangest entity in the physical universe. So strange, in fact, that we may even wonder if it is even physical at all. And yet, and here's the interesting thing about the photon, is that it is the source of everything that is physical. Even though we may question its own physicality, the photon is the source of everything that is physical. So, what's so strange about the photon, or the quantum? Well, for one thing, it has no mass and no charge. And it always moves at the speed of light. And that means there is no time for the photon, because, as Einstein showed, all clocks stop at the speed of light. The faster something moves, the slower time moves for that entity. And so something approaching the speed of light is slowing down and slowing down and slowing down until, if it ever reaches the speed of light, time stops completely at that point. That's central to Einstein's theory of relativity. So for a photon, there is no time. But furthermore, there's also no space for a photon, because a photon uses up no energy as it travels across space, even if it shoots from one side of the cosmos to the other. It has exactly the same amount of energy at the end of its journey as it had starting out. And anything that uses up zero energy as it travels through space, well, effectively experiences having traveled no distance in space. So, in a very real sense, then, the photon exists outside of ordinary dimensions of time and space. There is no time for a photon, and there is no space for a photon. And that's why the photon is not any ordinary physical entity. It is not composed of anything. It has neither mass, nor length, nor time. And yet the photon, the quantum of action, can be conceptually derived from the fundamental units of physics of mass, length, and time. And physicists use a very simple formula to describe the quantum of action. The formula is M for mass, L for length, squared over t for time. Now, some of you may be averse to formula, but actually this is very, very simple, and we're not going to get into a lot of mathematics or formula in this lecture. But this is an important point to recognize, that even though the photon, or the quantum, is not composed of anything, we can conceptually, in our own minds, not in reality, we can conceptually derive the photon from the equation, or from the formula, ML squared over T, mass multiplied by length squared over time. And length, of course, means distance. Now, as I said, some people feel uncomfortable with formulas, but this one simply means that the quantum of action can be described mathematically as mass, or M, multiplied by length, L, squared, which basically means length multiplied by itself. And all of this then is divided by the time it takes for that mass to travel the given distance. That's symbolized as L. Now, Young has repeatedly emphasized that the quantum of action always comes in whole units. And this is the basis of quantum physics, discovered by Max Planck and confirmed by Einstein, Heisenberg, Bohr, Schrödinger, and many, many other great physicists. The quantum is indivisible. It always comes in wholes. So although we can conceptually analyze the quantum into mass, length, and time, as I said, it is not composed of these. Actually, the photon is the source of the creator all its own components. Now, here we are confronting one of the puzzling aspects of the quantum domain, is that it is riddled with paradoxes. That in some ways, the whole, the photon, is the creator of its own components. In other words, the whole comes first, and then it provides or produces its own parts. If you have trouble picturing or understanding that, don't worry. At this level, understanding and normal concepts and normal language and our normal ways of thinking begin to fail us. We cannot have a clear understanding of what's going on, or a clear image of what's going on in the quantum wonderland. For example, here's one way of visualizing, if you like, the bizarreness, the impossibility of visualizing what's going on in the quantum domain. It's as if a complete house came first, and then it made its own bricks and timbers. Now, this does not make any sense from the perspective of our familiar experience, but the more we delve into the quantum wonderland, the more we realize that there's very little about the quantum that makes common sense. In fact, Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of quantum theory, said that the quantum domain is not only impossible to understand, it is impossible to even imagine what's happening there. He said that if you can imagine or picture what's going on in the quantum wonderland, that's your first clue that you are on the wrong track. So, if you have difficulty understanding what the quantum is and what it is doing, well, you may console yourself with the news that you're in very good company. No one, not even the greatest physicists of all time, can visualize or even think about the quantum without immediately misrepresenting it. The closest physicists could come is to use highly abstract and complex mathematics. Using Max Planck's constant, which lies at the heart of quantum physics, Arthur Young explained how action, which is symbolized as H, how action is quantized. In other words, action itself always comes in wholes. Young was fond of pointing out that you can never do just part of an action. You either, for example, you either get out of bed or you don't. And even if you slump halfway out of the bed, slumping itself is a whole action. So whatever the action is, it always comes in a whole, as a whole. Now, earlier on, we spoke about the quantum of action, and we left the word action undefined. But now we can show that action is energy multiplied by time. Remember that the components of action are mass, length, and time. So action is the whole of which mass, length, and time are the parts. In other words, the quantum of action, the primordial point at level 1, gives rise to time at level 2, then to space or distance at level 3, finally producing material objects at level 4. Furthermore, since action always comes in whole units, we call them quanta, which is the plural of quantum, and since, according to Arthur Young, action always has purpose, it follows that purpose, too, must be a property of the whole, of quanta, of photons, of light. Purpose, therefore, is not reducible, just like the photon, purpose is not reducible to mass, length, or time, the basic parameters recognized by orthodox science. But since science has no place for choice or purpose in the physical universe, it denies that the quantum has any purpose or that it could choose. You won't find in any mainstream physics textbook anything remotely discussing the idea that the quantum has purpose or choice. But Arthur Young insisted that it did. And this is the fundamental difference between Young's cosmology and the cosmology of standard physics. According to standard physics, the quantum is completely random. It's uncaused by anything. Quantum events just happen. But Young pointed out it makes equal sense to assume that what appears to an observer as randomness or chance is actually a quantum making a choice. Now, observationally, both randomness and choice are indistinguishable. Both are unpredictable. Logically, either one could be true. Yes, quantum events are unpredictable, and to an observer, they may seem random. But, and here's the point, from the perspective of the quantum itself, Young says, the event is anything but random, because it is the result of quantum choice. It is the result of the quantum exercising its own degree of freedom, its own choice. Young's idea of quantum choice accounts for all the facts just as well as the standard idea of quantum chance. So whether we go for quantum choice or quantum chance is really a matter of our own ultimate metaphysical preference. But if we want to be able to account for the fact of purpose or choice in the cosmos, and we know that as conscious beings we do have purpose and we do have choice, Young says then it makes far more sense to attribute quantum choice, not quantum chance, to the fundamental level of reality. And to do so, Young points out, is not to compromise any part of the current laws of physics. And Young's cosmology goes even further. By including choice at the level of the quantum, his model makes room for consciousness in the cosmos, because choice requires consciousness. The standard model of choiceless, purposeless quanta, on the other hand, has no room for consciousness. So in a nutshell, Young's great insight was this, that if we want a comprehensive cosmology, it must account for all the facts, including the facts of consciousness, as well as all the physical facts. Conventional quantum physics and all the sciences based on physics cannot account for mind or consciousness in the cosmos. But by making the shift from quantum chance to quantum choice, Young has created an opening for science to finally find a way to include consciousness and spirit in its worldview. As far as Young was concerned, there doesn't need to be a yawning gap between science and spirit, between our understanding of the physical world and our understanding of consciousness. We can have a science that includes both matter and mind, both the physical universe and consciousness. And any science that doesn't include both is incomplete. All it takes, Young said, are a few relatively minor shifts in our fundamental metaphysical assumptions about the nature of reality. For example, shifting from the idea of randomness to the idea of choice. In fact, Young said, we must make such a metaphysical shift if we are ever to have a science that can account for its own existence. In other words, a science that can account for consciousness, for knowing beings that create science in the first place. The simple shift from quantum chance to quantum choice is all it takes to liberate science from the straitjacket of materialism and the perennial puzzle of explaining the fact of consciousness in an otherwise physical universe. But Arthur Young had other very good reasons for including choice in the discourse of physics. And this takes us to the issue of control and what Young calls the third derivative. So very briefly, for the next couple of minutes, we will be talking the language of very basic physics. And as before, any talk of formulas may be disconcerting to some people. Now, if you are one of these, just bear with me. The ideas we are about to cover are really very simple, very straightforward, even if some of the language may be a little unfamiliar. And if you have any difficulty following this part of the lecture, then take the time to write out these very simple formulas or read about them in the assigned texts. Now remember, we are doing this because we want to understand why Arthur Young was so confident that we can open up science to include consciousness and spirit. He did so by asking a very simple question, the kind of question any high school kid might ask. The problem, as Young often pointed out, is that it seems physicists never thought of asking this very simple question themselves. If they had, he believes, we'd have had a very different kind of science. So, what is this very simple question that physicists never ask? Well, it's this. What is the third derivative? See, I told you that this question may seem a little strange or unfamiliar, but I promise it will all become very clear in just a few moments. So, here goes. Every physics freshman learns about mechanics, the study of how things move. So, imagine this. You place a glass bead or a marble on a table. It has position. In other words, it is at rest at one spot on the table. Physicists identify position with the letter L for length, The marble has a particular length that occupies its position on the table. Now, if we push the marble, it rolls from one position to another, and it takes some amount of time to move from position A to position B. Physicists signify the amount of time with the letter T. As the marble rolls, it changes position, and it does so at a measurable rate. So our first question, then, is what is the rate of change of position of the rolling marble? In other words, to simplify, we are asking what is the speed or the velocity of the marble? And this is very easy to figure out. We simply measure the distance between the starting and finishing positions of the marble and divide that number by the number of seconds it took to travel that distance. Let's say it traveled 12 inches and it took 2 seconds. So we'd divide 12 by 2 and come up with 6. The velocity of the marble then is 6 inches per second. But we don't even have to use numbers. We can say the velocity v is equal to distance l divided by time t. So we now have the very simple formula v for velocity or speed. V equals l divided by t, l over t. And this is called the first derivative of position with respect to time. So the first derivative is velocity, which is the rate of change of position. Okay, I hope you're with me so far. So far, so good. We noticed that when the marble moved, it first speeded up as a result of the push. Then it began to slow down before coming to rest at the second position. In other words, the speed or velocity of the marble changed. And that brings us to our second question. What is the rate of change of velocity? Now, usually, we call the rate of change of velocity acceleration. It is the rate of change of velocity over a given time. And we figure this out very easily by dividing velocity by the time it took for the acceleration to occur. Now, since we know that velocity of v equals l over t, we figure out that the acceleration is expressed by dividing l over t again by t. Now, written out, we'd simply jot down l over t squared, and this is the second derivative. The second derivative, in other words, is acceleration. So the first derivative is velocity. The second derivative is acceleration. And there's nothing at all mysterious about any of this. Every basic physics textbook would agree with all of this. But no physics textbook takes the next very simple step and asks, what is the rate of change of acceleration? What is the third derivative? How does acceleration change? What does L over T cubed to the power of 3 signify? It seems such an obvious and simple question. We may wonder why no physicist ever asked us, has ever asked it. Well, why indeed? Young's answer may provide a clue. To grasp his point, we'll change examples from a toy marble to a car. So, parked in the garage at home, your car has position, L, but it has no speed or velocity. Now, you hop into your car to drive to the local store, and as you move along the road, you are traveling at a particular speed, let's say 30 miles per hour. That's your velocity. We can easily figure out the first derivative for your car. This is the speed you are moving between your garage and your destination. At one point, you hit the gas to overtake a slower car, and you turn the steering wheel to swerve out and to give both cars plenty of room. You accelerate by picking up speed and by changing the direction of your movement. This is the second derivative. But, you wonder, what accounts for any change in acceleration? What, in other words, is the third derivative? Well, having just done it, you know very well what accounts for your change in acceleration. It was your decision to press the gas pedal and to turn the steering wheel. Both of these actions involved a form of control. You controlled the rate of change of acceleration by choosing to hit the gas and turn the wheel. So, the third derivative is control. And control always involves a choice. Choice or control is what causes acceleration to change. This was another of Arthur Young's simple but very profound insights. He saw that the third derivative is control, and that control implies choice, and that choice requires consciousness. The reason, he said, physicists never ask the simple question is because they know, or even unconsciously, that by asking it, they will blow wide open the key metaphysical assumption underlying all of modern science, that the universe has no consciousness of its own. Now remember, in an earlier lecture, we saw that laws and consciousness just don't mix. Well, physicists could not bring themselves to the point where control, choice, and consciousness automatically enter their equations. That would upset the materialist apple cart, and that's the profound significance of the third derivative. By asking just one more very simple question, physics would open up to the unavoidable reality of consciousness. Arthur Young saw that there is no yawning gap between science and spirit. Spirit or consciousness, he said, is already right there in physics, if only physicists had the courage and or the vision to take one more small step beyond understanding acceleration. By doing so, they would open up science to the recognition that consciousness, through choice and control, plays a significant role in the mechanics of the material world. Coupling this insight about the third derivative with the metaphysical shift from quantum chance to quantum choice, Arthur Young felt confident he could come up with a comprehensive cosmology, one that included consciousness as well as everything else we know about the universe from the practice of physical science. And he saw that consciousness and science need not be at all incompatible. So we should end this lecture at this point and return to more of Arthur Young's work in the next lecture.